the Soviet Union. A collection of states formed by an ideology called communism and a car industry fueled by a planned economy. A recipe for success or a recipe for disaster? That's what we're going to find out about an industry where some cars are more equal than others. An industry from a country where you don't drive a car, but the car drives you. Welcome everyone to episode 64 of the Automotive History series, where we are going to take a closer look at some Cold War motoring. Cars of the Soviet Union. Okay, to put it very bluntly and oversimplified, after the Second World War, two general ideological and geopolitical ideas spread across the globe, dividing the world in a Western Bloc and an Eastern Bloc. Both these sides had different opinions on how things should be managed, sometimes leading to friction, better known as the Cold War. The Western Bloc lived by the idea of individual development, a slice of capitalism, and a belief in a free market, led by such superpowers like the United States and followed by Western countries. The Eastern Bloc lived with the idea of the group, with a slice of communism and collectivism, and a pre-planned economy instead of a free market, led by such superpowers like Russia and its satellite states, eventually forming the Soviet Union. Both sides looked forward to a bright future after the horrors of the war, and wanted to rapidly modernize the country's industry and society. A strong car industry was a hobby horse for many, to show the rest of the world that they were with the times. The car industries of many Western countries were based around the foundations of a free market, and simply supply and demand. If there was a need for basic and low-cost transportation, then eventually a car company would fulfill this need. If there was an appetite for expensive, ultra-luxurious cars, then some companies would fulfill this desire. If demand vanishes, these companies will also disappear or be replaced or bought out by a stronger competitor. That's just how it goes. And as you can see, this naturally leads to a balanced car industry, with various companies offering various models for various prices, shaped by the whims of a free market. The Soviet Union also wanted to show the world that this level of supply and different automotive flavors was also possible in a planned economy. And so the Soviets set up a pecking order of car brands, from basic people's cars to impressive luxury cars for government officials. This system was conveniently implemented before they checked if there was an actual demand for these cars in the first place, but decided to build them anyway. Let's go through these ranks and take a look at some of these cars. Prior to the launch of the plans for a national car industry, there was almost no national car industry in Russia, and most of the vehicles produced were actually freight trucks. Some small-scale passenger car production eventually developed, but were mostly licensed models from foreign car makers, like the GUZ A, which is essentially a rebadged Ford Model A. The GUZ logo was even similar to the Ford logo. But after the war, this all had to change. As part of the automotive industry plan, various factories would be established all over the Soviet Union. Some local car brands, or what now were Soviet satellite states, were also incorporated. These factories were often named after the location they were built, or named after some important figure, and also gave the name of the car company that was going to build the cars there. For example, the Gorkovsky Avtomobilny Zavod, meaning the Gorky Automobile Plant. And especially that last part, so Automobile Plant, or AZ, is commonly found on other Russian car brands. Only the letter before that is changed, resulting in such abbreviations like GUZ, WAZ, VAZ, and ZUZ. Now you know. So let's start at the bottom of the ladder. What if you are, let's say, a humble farmer, a bedniak? Where do you get your car? Well, you don't. Go take the bus, you filthy peasant. And there was actually some truth in that, as most vehicles produced in the Soviet Union weren't actually passenger cars, but city buses and, above all, freight trucks. No, it was a classic case of rules for thee, but not for me, as those government officials that came up with the automotive industry plan were also the first to treat themselves on some fine automobiles. The first of which comes from Guz. In 1946, right after the war, the company released the M20, nicknamed Pobeda, meaning freedom. A great effort, considering it's among the first post-war cars to feature the all-new fenderless pontoon styling. Overall, the styling seems to be somewhat of a mix of European and American car models. This middle-class machine was loved for its simplicity and ruggedness, while at the same time offering quite a few modern options, such as electric windshield wipers, a heater, and AM radio. A modest 2.1-liter four-cylinder pulled the car through the vast Russian landscapes. After a few years, the Pobeda was joined by an even more upscale model, the Guz 12, or Zim 12. The 12 was a full-on luxury car, and can be seen as somewhat of a compact limousine. It's certainly not small, with an overall length of over 5.5 meters, and could carry up to 6 or 7 people, or 8 if you know where to stuff it. Power came from a 3.5-liter straight-six, tuned in such a way to get the maximum out of Russian fuel in all the parts of the world known as spicy water. The design of the car seems to be very much influenced by various American cars from the late 40s, especially the bathtub style like the Mercurys and the Hudsons, and the front-end style reminding me of a Cadillac. In the meantime, the Western car industry, and namely the American car industry, developed new cars, designs, and technology at a relentless pace. And thanks to year-to-year design changes, cars radically changed in their appearance. The space race was on. And as much as the Soviets tried to be a step ahead with the space race high in the sky, they also tried to keep up with the space race on four wheels. 1958 proved to be an important year, when three Soviet car companies released new versions of their cars. The M20 Pobeda was replaced by the M21, better known as the Volga. This new car featured a fresh new design that I would really classify as Russian, or European to say the least. There's not really a car out there that I can think of that tries to copy its design. When you think of classic Soviet transport, you think of Volga. As a slightly upmarket car, it was deemed not good enough for the party officials, but a great car for such jobs like ambulances and taxis, and also for the apparatchiks, like the KGB, the Soviet spy agency. If you saw a Volga in almost any color, you'd be fine. If you saw a Volga in black, you should be somewhat careful, and if you saw a Volga in black stopping right in front of your home, you should be very much worried. In fact, people were so scared of black Volgas that it created its own legend. The legend of the black Volga was a story often told in Russia and Soviet states. According to the story, you should be careful at night as you could be chased or stopped by a black Volga. And next thing you know, you're kidnapped and never to be seen or heard of again. And who's driving the Volga? Well, that could be anything evil, including the KGB, the Russian mafia, or in some other versions, the devil himself. Higher up at the ladder, we find the Guz 12 that would be replaced by the Guz 13, better known as a Packard. Chaika. Please don't send me to the gulags. The Chaika was arguably one of the poster cars of the Soviet Union. For a Soviet car, it was as unabashedly capitalistic American as it could get. American dimensions, American-sized engine, a 5.5-liter V8, and above all, American style. And that's what I want to talk about. Many say it looks a lot like a mid-50s Packard, and some say it actually was a Packard underneath. And for the longest time, I also genuinely thought that this was something of a Packard, that, I don't know, Packard worked out some shady deal with the Soviets in the 50s. But then you have to realize that we are at the height of the Cold War. Packard would be absolutely stupid to secretly share technology with the Soviets, and would be cancelled right on the spot. And if you look more closely, you'll see that it looks much like a Packard, but the car is also influenced by many other American styling trends at the time. The hooded headlights were also common on the Mercurys and Plymouth of those years, and the rear looks somewhat like a 1957 Pontiac. But let's say that I find it very fascinating that those countries that absolutely despise everything that comes from the West are also the ones that like to make their own products look as much like as they came from the West. Strange. Anyway, the Chaika wasn't enough to satisfy the nomenklatura, as Chaikas can be considered as a mid-level Cadillac or Mercedes. What the Soviet Union really lacked was an official state car. A car that would show the world the true power and engineering of the Soviet car industry. A car that exceeds the likes of the Cadillac Fleetwood limousines and the Mercedes Grosser 600s. And that car was the ZIL 111. The 111 was like the bigger brother of the Chaika, featuring a very similar design, but a much larger in size and even more chromed up. The car was over 6 meters in length and was powered by a 6-liter V8. The rear featured styling that made it look even more like a Packard. But, in traditional Soviet fashion, the car was quickly updated with a new design in 1962, looking somewhat like a Cadillac you ordered off AliExpress. No tail fins on the rear, however, but a straightforward design with two round tail lights, reminding me of early 60s Chevrolets. The Zils were the official state cars of the Soviet Union and only used by those working in the highest layers of the party. And now that I'm talking about a party, not only did these officials enjoy luxury traveling, what was also part of the package were the so-called Zil lanes. Certain lanes on Moscow's major roads were closed off for regular traffic and only reserved for Zils and Chaikas. According to some news sources, an entire intersection was frequently closed off to give way to government cars passing by, often resulting in complete traffic jams. So, the Soviet party officials, the nomenklatura, enjoyed unobstructed and comfortable luxury traveling in their big Zils, although they could never own these cars as they were owned by the state. In that case, you had to sign up for a Chaika. Then you had the apparatchiks and the KGB officers enjoying their everyday but still luxurious Volgas. But what about the common man? Well, back in the 50s, for those that could afford it, there was actually one car brand I just quickly want to mention, and that is Moskvich. A mid-market company positioned below GUZ, comparable to the European Opels and Fords. And will you look at these cars? I mean, come on, these are some happy-looking cars, available in bright colors. And they were a relative success, allowing some Russian people that were better off than others to own their own set of wheels. Throughout the life, Moskvichs were regularly updated with new, fresh designs and even made it abroad. Quite a few Moskvichs were exported to Soviet satellite states and even the Western world, where they were often seen as a value for money alternative. But even these cars were almost unobtainable by the majority of the Soviet people. And according to the Soviet government, this had to change. The Union was in need of a basic, low-cost people's car. Up until the 1960s, they did have a car lying around that somewhat fulfilled this role, the ZUS Zaporozhets, from the ZUS car company located in Soviet Ukraine. The first generation of this car was obviously inspired by the Fiat 600, although it was radically different underneath. The most well-known version of this car came around in the mid-60s, the 966, and later the 968. These cars look very similar to various European cars like the Hillman Imp and the Enezu Prince, which were influenced by the American Chevrolet Corvair from the start of the 60s. These cars were somewhat affordable, but very small with a low level of comfort after all. And in the mid-60s, the Soviet government began to negotiate with several Western car brands to see if they could work out a deal to make a mass-produced people's car. It was easier for the Soviets to let someone else with loads of experience take care of it than to figure it out themselves. Ultimately, Fiat was chosen and helped the Soviets in setting up factories and assembly lines. By 1970, the production had started of what would become the Soviet Union and Russia's most recognizable car, the VAZ 2101, better known as the Lada. If you think this is a truly Russian car, then you're somewhat right, but you might have to think again. The Lada was nothing more than a Fiat 124, albeit slightly changed and tweaked here and there to better suit the Soviet infrastructure and harsh Russian terrain. The car was slightly jacked up, had thicker body panels, and a different engine. And I could sit here talking endlessly about Lada, but I think you already know what happened. The Lada became the official people's car for Russia for many decades to come, and a cultural icon at that. You still see them on Russian roads today. And how many videos you can find on YouTube that involves Lada stunts and shenanigans or, you know, those Russian car crashes? It was a no-nonsense, basic and affordable people's car that barely changed in its 40-year lifespan. And not only that, the car was also successful in many other countries, mostly sold as an absolute bottom-of-the-barrel economy car. Finally, the automotive industry of the Soviet Union was complete and matched with the rest of the world. So, to wrap it up, If you wanted low cost and basic transportation for inner city use, you could buy a ZAZ Zaporozhet, which was the Soviet equivalent of a Fiat 500. If you wanted low cost basic transportation that was slightly bigger and more comfortable, then you bought a Lada, the Soviet equivalent of a Volkswagen Beetle. If you were a solid middle class citizen, you had a Moskvich, the Soviet equivalent of a Ford or Opel. And if you were a doctor, policeman, or working for the KGB, you drove a Volga, the Soviet equivalent of a lower-priced Mercedes or Chrysler. If you were a party member or otherwise had an influential job, you had a Chaika, the Soviet equivalent of a higher-priced Mercedes or Cadillac. And if you were part of the nomenklatura, a top government official or even a party leader, you were carried around in the back of a Zil, the Soviet equivalent of the top-of-the-line Mercedes and Lincolns. This system of cars and brands looks good, right? But as the Soviet Union progressed through the 60s, 70s and 80s, its many faults and shortcomings became visible. And this also seeped through the car industry. It was a planned economy after all, and this led to huge levels of bureaucracy. The Soviet car industry acted very slow and often grinded to a halt. New and fresh ideas barely came through and many developments were slowly implemented, if they were implemented at all. This led to such stories like a continuous shortage of materials at factories. Materials and resources that had very low quality. Lousy fit and finish. Cars that already rusted on the assembly line. Machinery that often broke down. Assembly lines that often stalled. Cars that had to be finished or were produced entirely by hand. Not to mention that many cars were often still expensive for the majority of the Soviet people. And even if they did manage to have enough money for a car, they would be put on a very long waiting list. It could take years before your car was ready. This and numerous other factors contributed to an overall image that Soviet cars were generally awful, and often target of many jokes, especially from the West. A famous example is the US President Ronald Reagan telling a joke that the Soviet citizen was lucky enough to receive a car and the delivery date was set, although it would still take a couple years. The citizen then asks if they delivered the car in the morning or the afternoon. Well, what difference does that make? That's far into the future. Yes, says the citizen, it does make a difference because the plumber is coming in the morning. And so how the car industry struggled, so did the entire Soviet Union, slowly crumbling and eventually falling apart. The communist dream was over and the Union dissolved in 1991. With the dissolution of the communist empire, Russia sought new ways to rule the nation. This time a more Western approach was embraced, and this also had a huge impact on the Russian car industry. The Russian government opened the gates for Western car makers who instantly overruled the local market with their highly advanced and quality cars. The Russian car makers, many of which still made cars that were essentially stuck in the 60s, were no match to the newly arrived rivals. Many Russian car makers stopped producing their decade-long model series and either vanished or started a partnership with a Western brand. ZAZ stopped making Zaporozhets, although they continued with the Tavria, Zil stopped making limousines, and Moskvich experienced legal troubles and bankruptcy. Lada eventually discontinued the 2101 as it was increasingly harder to sell in export markets, letting it comply with the latest regulations, but did continue as a brand, releasing several new models during the 1990s and is still active today. Guzz, in the meantime, made a successor for the Chaika, an absolute battlecruiser of a car, with a front-end design taken off a mid-60s Lincoln and a rear-end design taken off a Mercedes, but that car was already discontinued in the late 80s before the fall of the Union. But this cannot be said of the Volga. Guzz faithfully stuck with the car during the 1990s and 2000s, trying to update the styling to keep up with the design trends. But with every new generation of the car, it just became worse. A great example is this phone number on wheels, the 31105. According to Guzz, this car was an ode to the original Volgas of the 50s and the 60s, more or less celebrating the retro wave that was going on at the time. Sure, but I see it as a bad excuse to hide the fact that this car is simply ancient. Look at the midsection of the car, badly hiding that it comes straight from the 1960s. What is arguably the final nail in the coffin of the Russian car industry is also the final generation of Volgas. It says a lot when the latest car you released is not even Russian, but a Chrysler, an American car. The Volga Sieber, the last Volga made, was nothing more than a rebased Chrysler Sebring, a car coming from a nation you absolutely hated the last 50 years. Talking about rubbing it in. As of today, it is only Lada that sells a variety of modern cars and frequently tops the list of most cars sold in Russia. But there is also room for newcomers like Auris. Auris cars are the new official state cars and ultra-luxury cars, kind of like Zil Part 2. And in traditional Russian fashion, it vaguely reminds you of some Western cars, but you can't quite put your finger on it. All I see is a Chrysler 300 with a Rolls-Royce grille. Lots of other car companies all over the world are also active in Russia. Well, that was until, well, what I like to call Putin's personal passion project involving another sovereign nation that actually turned out to be a lot tougher than they initially thought. And as a result, much of the Western world has cancelled Russia, including the car industry. According to Western news sources, the Russian car industry has completely collapsed, as almost all non-Russian car makers have left the country, and it's currently very hard to buy any Western car in Russia. But these are simply Western lies, as the Russian car industry is actually doing great. We don't see any problems whatsoever. Those traders that have left the country sold their factories back to the Russian government. And in traditional Soviet fashion, it is the government that regains control over these factories. And what if there is a shortage of important car parts? We'll just drop it altogether. New Russian cars are simply sold without emission controls, anti-lock braking systems, and airbags. Because who the hell needs airbags? Let's relive our youth again, comrade. And wouldn't you know it, it's the perfect time to revive the once legendary Soviet car industry. Russia has announced that old brands like Moskvich are getting a reboot, with some fresh new cars. And these cars are all designed and built in Russia, right? Well, not really, because much of the cars are rebadged, and you may take a guess where these cars are coming from. Right, China. Russia's dear old friend. And so who knows what the future will hold for the Russian car industry. By the looks of it, a new, glorious period of prosperity will befall the industry. Just like the good old days.